Welcome to CR Amplified, the Cairo Reviews podcast where we talk to experts and policymakers about relevant issues on the world stage. I'm Jacob Lau. Today, I will be continuing my discussion with Dr. Matthew K. Shannon in this two-part series on the history of U.S. Christian missionaries in Iran during the Pahlavi dynasty. Dr. Shannon will be speaking on his recently published book, Mission Manifest, American Evangelicals in Iran in the 20th Century. He's currently an associate professor of history at Emory and Henry University and an expert on the history of U.S.-Iranian relations. Dr. Shannon will be joining the Department of History at the American University of Cairo as a full-time faculty member in the fall of 2025. Last episode, Dr. Shannon and I spoke about the origin of the Christian mission in Iran and how it existed in the context of U.S. foreign policy as a means to exert imperialism despite the rising tides of nationalism that were starting to sweep in Iran. Today, we will be speaking about the relationship between U.S. Christian missionaries and Iranian evangelicals through the lens of culture. We'll be looking at various development programs that included social work, education, and healthcare, and how after 1965, these programs became nationalized by local Iranians. Furthermore, we'll be talking about cultural integration, personal relationships in space, and how these aspects changed for U.S. missionaries in the years leading up to the 1979 Islamic Revolution.
Also, you speak about in the book that, like, within this development, and especially after 1965, which you state as the year that the Iranian evangelical church sort of gains independence from this home base, there are some positive byproducts that come out of the Christian mission. And you talk a lot about literacy, schooling, and social work. And while this did coincide with Mohammad Reza Shah's development program, it also had some important influence, specifically with Iranians who led this development. And you talked about Farmian. And maybe if you want to talk a little bit about this.
It's such an important question. I'm really glad that you've asked that, because, you know, one of the lines that I try to walk in the book is to, you know, kind of stress the, coercive superstructure that is, you know, kind of surrounding all of this history, right? Whatever we want to call it, imperial or something else. But I'm also trying to understand what the various kind of impacts are on the ground, both institutionally and on a personal level, in ways that, you know, sometimes surprise us, right? Or, you know, kind of give us a different type of perspective on, you know, the longer term impact of not just mission work, but some of these cultural and developmental programs that other Americans are involved in, too. So, you know, the title of the book is Mission Manifest. Ultimately, I demonstrate that there are various manifestations of this, you know, Presbyterian American Iranian shared mission in downtown Tehran. And it's not just the churches, right? So another manifestation of that shared mission comes in the form of development programs, broadly defined. There are two case studies. One case study is on literacy work, both mission literacy work, U.S. aid literacy work, and then ultimately the Shah of Iran's literacy corps, right? So you see this kind of genealogy of kind of literacy programming through the three shared missions. And as you mentioned, I also look at the question of social work and what the relationship between this one clinic, maternal clinic in South Tehran, was to the broader maternal welfare state and the social work programming that Sattareh Farm and Farmayan developing on her own at the same time. So as an example, this particular clinic becomes part of Farm and Farmayan's broader network of the School of Social Work, right? So here's an example where when the institutions start to get their independence, so to speak, coming out of the Commonwealth stage, it's not just the church, it's all of these institutions that we have to think about. And in the case of some of the social work programming with the clinic work, we see There are some direct ties to Sauterie Farm and Farmignon's National Social Work Project, right? So that's presumably a good thing where people are able to kind of get services they need, and that some of these kind of often underfunded, understaffed, constantly changing mission projects were able to get a degree of stability under kind of the broader kind of government emergent welfare state of the Pahlavi government, right? There would be other examples, schools, right? So there's a chapter on schools. The community school of Tehran really becomes like an international Iranian institution. So a school that began for like Mish kids is now serving, elite Iranians at large, in the 1970s. The Iran Bethel School for Women is transformed into Damavand College, which becomes one of the first, quote unquote, modern liberal arts schools for Iranian women. There are the various cultural associations that I discuss, right? We could go into some of the other examples. But yes, I was fascinated by the ways in which institutions that were established, by Presbyterian missionaries, and in some cases, some of these US government cultural programs too, how what began like from, you will think of this in terms of like cultural imperialism, right? But on the ground in Tehran, as kind of the mission and place are converging, they are adapted to new circumstances, and they're often kind of taken into like a new life, so to speak, by the very people that those institutions were created for, right? So these missionary institutions, many of them become Iranian institutions or international institutions doing kind of much bigger things and moving away from some of the evangelical impulses, for instance, and adopting a more secular model, right? Whether it's in the literacy work or the social work or the schooling or any of the other examples, we see, especially after 1965, when that Presbyterian mission shutters, those institutions are set loose and they kind of have 15 years to reinvent themselves before there is another change during the Revolution of 79, right?
And it's so interesting to me that you talk about this idea of cultural imperialism, because I feel like it's such an understudied topic in history, in studying the post-colonial era and colonialism during, or post-colonialism during the Cold War. So I want to talk about this and run with this a little bit, and specifically talking about the American experience in Iran. So moving back in time a little bit. I know we're jumping all over the place a little bit, but it's okay. So in 1941, we talked about the Allies invading Iran, and then this seemed to be much to the benefit of the Presbyterian mission, because these allies sort of unexpectedly discovered these missionary establishments. And one soldier, I want to pull a quote from your book, and one soldier talked about one of these missionaries' home, saying, quote, "His home has been an oasis for soldiers who have visited there, a bit of Tennessee transplanted to the heart of Persia." So I want to talk about, like, sort of, this is like a downward trajectory or spiral of American integration in Iran in a cultural sense, in saying that Americans sort of get less and less and less integrated and become more isolated in Iranian culture. But in the beginning, what were some of the reasons why expats felt so at home in Iran? And how did Christian missionaries cultivate this experience? And then how did this go sort of towards a downward spiral?
Oh, it's a wonderful question. The book isn't like a policy book, but it's a foreign relations book, but we're looking at kind of relations on multiple levels, right? And one of the levels that I think is most interesting is what you just touched on, right? The human experience of expatriate life in Pahlavi Iran, right? So let's, the quote that you found is fascinating, right? I mean, again, you have American GIs who aren't really super, prepared to encounter, other societies. I mean, missionaries, most of them have at least a degree of preparation and eventually language skills and stuff like that. So that quote's fascinating because it's like you kind of see that, quest for familiarity, right? From the American GIs. They're kind of dropped down 6,000 miles away from home and they don't know what to they're going to find. And when they find little kind of pieces of Americana, they seem to be taken by it. And you'll see other examples of that in the book. This, you'd see examples of that in history and contemporary life in Iran and other places. It's not like a unique phenomenon. But the soldiers in some of these letters are often like amplifying their feelings to kind of testify to the value of these missions as we kind of move into the post-war years, right? I would argue that there are different types of Americans in this story as well, right? Some are more interested in integrating with society, like being part of Tehran, living in the city, and others aren't, right? So the missionaries, interestingly, right, really are attempting to kind of integrate themselves into society. When you look at those maps, right, you'll see that most of those mission institutions are located in like downtown Tehran, right? They're right there, near the Majlis building or, other kind of major sites, government or otherwise, in downtown Tehran. Like they can walk down the street and interact with their friends who are like heads of the National Bank, right? So the missionaries, again, they have their blind spots, right? But they are kind of living and working and eating and breathing in downtown Tehran through most of this period, right? Now, that's not true for like all of the different subgroups of the American colony in Tehran, right? So, for instance, when we think about military contractors, especially those who start to come in large numbers, say post 64, 65, or even really most of the GIs, right? They're kind of on bases and stuff like that outside of the city. A lot of these other Americans who maybe don't have that quote unquote heart-to-heart attachment to Iran that some of the missionaries profess to have, they don't live in the city. As the 60s and 70s progress, Tehran evolves considerably and it begins to move like north. There are kind of new suburbs, that are being created in North Tehran. The government is opening up public land to develop new neighborhoods and schools. And of course, all of this is totally, kind of developed out now in Tehran. But there's like a compound in North Tehran that eventually, a lot of these secular institutions, so the English language church for expats, or the big school for expats, the Tehran America School, not the community school, which had an international community, but they kind of move up to this compound, commissary facilities, different things, right? So in that last chapter, I talk about, this idea of the northern tier of Tehran and kind of the segregation of the American colony at the very time that it's growing in size to kind of demonstrate how the disconnect post 65 can be understood in relation to the physical space of Tehran, right? That it's like we move from that period where the missionaries and their friends are moving about in downtown, relatively integrated with their blind spots and all. To like a totally segregated community where, you read about some of the these kind of military folks in the 70s who just aren't happy there, right? I mean, people are just kind of trying to replicate this the so-called Tennessee in the heart of Persia without knowing that to live a good life in Iran, they need to abandon that way of thinking and kind of adapt more to local circumstances, right? So, kind of the recklessness of post-65 U.S. foreign policy toward Iran and the massive defense expenditures and sales that we see in the 70s, we can kind of see the same kind of mentality as that northern tier colony becomes manifest in Tehran. And whereas the missionaries actually seem to like the Americans who come in the Second World War, they don't see like the missionaries who are sticking around in the 60s and 70s, however small a number they are. They don't see the developments of the 60s and 70s in a favorable light, right? They see it as making it very difficult to be an American in Tehran, and they see a lot of the newcomers who are getting in traffic accidents and getting in brawls on the streets, right, as being a signifier that the ugly American has arrived in Tehran. And no matter what any other group may try to do, that ugly American image, of course, is the one that has the big impact, kind of on the Iranian population in the 70s as we move toward the
And
revolution.
I mean, moving towards the revolution, it seems to me that this American mission that sort of trumps the Presbyterian mission later in the 70s leads to this negative view that Iranians have towards Americans. And there's you explain in the book how there's thousands of military personnel and contractors in Iran during leading up to the revolution. And then you talked about, there's this one part of the book where you talked about people graffitiing then on Presbyterian compounds and properties, get leave Americans leave. So even though maybe the Presbyterians themselves saw themselves differently than the military personnel and the contractors, it didn't really seem any different to Iranians. And then the anti-American perspective that sort of was held in the 70s and then later by the Ayatollah.
I think that's a really fair point. And we'd have to think more about how this kind of holds up over time, as far as, whether or not these types of distinctions, are kind of perceptible to time, right? Or if it's something that, as time passes, we can kind of start to see these nuances. But you're absolutely right to kind of point out that during the revolution, there aren't distinctions really being made, right? At least by revolutionaries and people who are taking the revolution to the streets, between this or that type of American institution, right? So, for instance, yes, I talk about how the community school of Tehran starts to experience some of this early on with some of the graffiti, but some of these schools have to shut down during the revolution. And let me help. I'll kind of give an example to put this into context. So ultimately, to kind of swing back around to the big picture of kind of cultural relations between the U.S. and Iran, there are a little more than 50,000 Iranian students in the U.S. when the revolution happens. It's the largest group of international students in the U.S. at the time, right? Way more than there are today. There are about 50,000 Americans in Iran when the revolution happens, right? So let's just kind of generally say 100,000 people, kind of who are kind of moving about and are part of this transnational experience, whose mobility and in some cases livelihoods will be completely transformed by the hostility that emerges between the U.S. and Iran during and after the revolution, right? In the United States during the hostage crisis, the INS begins mandatory screenings of Iranian students, and eventually visas stop getting issued. The population shrinks dramatically. This is its own history, right? That's been written. But in Iran, that American colony will go from nearly 50,000 when the summer of 1978 ends to about 1,000 when the hostage crisis begins. And many of those 1,000 are like dual nationals or maybe people who married an Iranian in the 70s and they have children and they move to Iran. You know, there are some business people getting their houses in order or other miscellaneous folks, but like that's like a whole colony, right? Foreign colony that is nationalized. It ceases to exist. And it happens in about a year. That's going to like the properties themselves are part of that history, right? So in the book, I kind of write about this. We all know about the taking of the U.S. Embassy on November 4th, 1979, right? But there's the earlier taking of the embassy attempt in February 1979, right? So there's the failed attempt in February 79, the quote unquote successful attempt in November. Between that time, right? So in February, and we know there are different reasons why the February takeover didn't, you know, kind of last the way the November one did, but you know, there's one issue of question of foreign property and will that property still be respected or will it be nationalized? Right. So in early 79, we don't know the answer to the question. In late 79, we see the answer. In between, right, there are takeovers of religious, you know, old Presbyterian properties. So, you know, the big one that happens is the Community School of Tehran, right before the start of the academic year, in, you know, the 79-80 academic year, the like revolutionaries take over the compound, right? And there are some negotiations, and eventually the Presbyterians leave, right? So that kind of hospital compound, so to speak, in downtown East Tehran becomes a different institution and entity after that nationalization moment in 1979. That school moves to far north Tehran to finish out the academic year, and then it's no longer allowed to operate. And those last half dozen or so Presbyterians that I write about do not have their work permits renewed in the summer of 1980, right? But this idea of making distinctions between the diplomatic colony and the mission community. We see that in the seizure of properties and, you know, kind of the liquidation of, you know, these foreign communities and their holdings, that there aren't distinctions made. And that the community school compound and the embassy compound, despite their differences, essentially meet the same fate. Even if over time, maybe certain groups are thought about differently or more favorably than others, either on the American or Iranian side. In that moment of the revolution, it seems to be a distinction without a difference, right? At the same time, missionaries weren't taken hostage. They were living and working freely. There are, you know, I mean, there's a deeper history here to get into, but, you know, what some of the Americans who actually can stay safely in Iran through the summer of 1980 are able to kind of do, it's quite impressive, right? They're able to do things and live in a way that wasn't the case for their diplomatic counterparts. So even though the institutions and the properties and the compounds meet a similar fate, the individuals have a different experience, right?
And then, of course, we see how anti-American rhetoric and political Islam in Iran sort of coincide with each other. And then the revolution ensues. So, talking a little bit about this and then wrapping up, how does the history of American evangelicalism in the Middle East inform us about current Middle Eastern affairs? What are some myths regarding this American evangelicalism in the Middle East and its relationship to political Islam? And lastly, what are some examples today that we see evangelicals involved in Middle Eastern affairs?
It's a great question. And again, I should just kind of, I want your listeners to know that this is a subject I'm approaching as a historian. I don't have any, you know, connection to these types of movements or any like insider information beyond the research, right? I just make sure that everybody understands that. So there are a couple different ways to think about it. I mean, again, you ask a really good question, right? And so when we think about this moment that I study, it's really just one wave in the broader history of like the American foreign mission movement. So in the conclusion, I talk about this, that the Presbyterian mission, this kind of mainline Protestant kind of mission moment, that crests from, let's say, the late 19th century to the mid 20th century, is sandwiched between two other, kind of different periods of the foreign mission movement, right? So there were missionaries in Iran, prior to the Presbyterians, some of these, the ABCFM Mission Board, and some of the Congregationalists and others, right? These would have been like folks who not only would have been in Iran, but they would have been like working with Native Americans, Cherokee in the United States, and things like this. And post 1960s, of course, there's still a lot of evangelical activity going on in the world. And even if it's not being kind of led by these mainline churches, it's often being led by more conservative churches and kind of independent mission societies. So again, this idea that there are moments where missionaries or religion more broadly, I should say, matter, and moments where it doesn't, that's a myth. It always matters, right? So for instance, just because the Presbyterians close up shop in 1965, that doesn't mean that religion doesn't remain a mediating factor or force in U.S.-Iran relations moving forward. And again, I'm just speaking from the American side. So why does it matter today? And for instance, how do the dispelling of those myths help us understand why this history is still relevant today? We know that American evangelicals are a central, block, on the in the American conservative movement. And when we think about like U.S. policy toward Israel or whatever it may be, we have to understand not just the geopolitical factors, but also some of kind of the religious drivers of American foreign policy more broadly, right? So religion is central to U.S. foreign policy, U.S. foreign relations. I hope I demonstrate that, how it worked in the context of Pahlavi Iran, but we have studies about, American evangelicals in Israel, American evangelicals in Lebanon, kind of in the more contemporary period, whatever the case may be. So I think that's really significant. There could be a couple other examples. So the idea that there are like these narratives about, again, to kind of swing back to where we began, a dialogue, right? Kind of, I'm arguing, hopefully persuasively, that there has been a series of dialogues between Americans and Iranians that are often shaped by the broader international kind of system, but then take their own dynamics on the ground, whether it's leftist students protesting at Berkeley in the 60s, or whether it's missionaries working with their Iranian partners doing social work. But those dialogues are, again, they're contested. They're often very prickly, right? They're not often ever resolved, right? So this idea that there's like an either-or option, there's like international hostility on the one hand, or a kumbaya moment on the other. I hope I show that it's really not either, that these two, kind of factors are constantly in like a dialectic relationship with each other, right? And there might be other points that we can consider, but I think at least those kind of two points, I hope, are myths that are dispelled, that in turn can help us understand the relevance of this book to contemporary considerations, right? The ever-present influence of religion in U.S. international affairs, broadly defined, and how to kind of think about the these middle grounds between clash and dialogue, and think about kind of contested and often unresolved dialogues between individuals in addition to societies. I hope that that's something that folks, appreciate from the book.
Thank you so much, Professor. And maybe, like, just just lastly, like in a couple sentences, if you could give some advice to young historians out there who are studying American imperialism in a post-colonial context, what would
Yeah,
you
it's a
say?
great question. I mean, one of the most important things is to ask questions, like, really engaging, often difficult questions that you're passionate about, right? But that could also kind of compel you to kind of rethink the complexities of the international system, right? So to have a question, right? And we know that archival research and working through the historiography, there are various ways that we come to these questions. But I think if you have that question, right, assuming that it can be answered in some way, kind of with, the sources that we're kind of trained to use, I think you'll find that your research will always be, enjoyable, and that you'll find ways to become, part of the conversation, so to speak, right? Because kind of that kind of exercise of asking questions really is a way to kind of get yourself into that conversation in a way that historians will understand, or interdisciplinary scholars studying international affairs.
Thank you,
Thank
Professor.
you
Thank
so
you so much
much.
for being here.
That concludes today's episode of this two-part series on the history of U.S. Christian missionaries in Iran. I want to thank Zaina Hafiz for producing this podcast, along with Abigail Flynn and the American University of Cairo's Journalism and Mass Communication Department for helping throughout the process. And of course, I want to thank Dr. Matthew K. Shannon for taking the time to speak with me. Tune in next time on CR Amplified.